Today on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
We cannot allow the pandemic to be used as a cover to continue or exacerbate the ugly history of voter suppression.
The House Select Subcommittee discussed concerns about voting safety and availability in Florida, Texas, Wisconsin, and Georgia.
Well, for one, stop talking about it in the way that we all know about it already. We know the nature of the leadership in the country, and that's fine. It works for a group of individuals.
Sister Dr. Jenna, an acclaimed spiritual mentor, talks about coping with violence, racism, and the pandemic.
In some of the media, they said that Southern Louisiana dodged the bullet, but that's completely opposite from what we saw yesterday.
And we'll hear voices from the Gulf Coast of Louisiana about the impact of Hurricane Laura, a Category 4 storm that struck the coast with deadly winds over 150 miles per hour. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Network and radio affiliates focused on COVID-19 and the ways in which this pandemic touches our lives. I'm your host, Akua Holt. On August 27th, Hurricane Laura slammed into Lake Charles, Louisiana, and nearby towns. New Orleans was spared, and the story quickly dropped from the headlines. But residents of smaller cities and towns in Louisiana are still suffering displacement, damage to their homes, and utility shutoffs, with little government relief. Pacifica's Ann Garrison reports.
Members of the Party for Socialism and Liberation and their presidential candidate, Gloria LaRiva, traveled to Lake Charles, Louisiana, and the surrounding region to deliver material aid like food, bottled water, and sanitation supplies. They also spoke to members of the community and recorded their voices. Here are some of their voices and the voices of residents they recorded.
We have been here in Louisiana. We have been to Lake Charles for 2 days this weekend to ascertain what is going on with people and working class people on the ground. We have seen quite a bit of lack of resources. We have not seen any government intervention, any help for most of the people. They have mostly been left to themselves.
That the Trump administration lay out billions of dollars for recovery in Lake Charles and the surrounding area, because it's more than Lake Charles that's been affected, to restore the electricity, to restore people's homes, and to have FEMA have intake workers throughout the community.
It was eye-opening what we saw in Lake Charles yesterday. People are suffering. In some of the media, they said that Southern Louisiana dodged the bullet. But that's completely opposite from what we saw yesterday. Houses are destroyed, people's lives are destroyed, everything they own is destroyed.
We've been living outside for like 3 days out here in my front yard. My whole roof is collapsed, and the back of the house collapsed, and the other roof. They have water all in the house. All my furniture is damaged. Everything is going bad around here. No electricity, no water.
Me and my fiance be looking for hotels to stay in, and just none available around here.
I so appreciate what y'all done for me today. That mean a lot to me, man.
Can we get you anything else?
I'm
don't
not
be
lying.
Shy.
Hey, that mean a lot. It's a lot right now. It mean a lot to me. I'm going through a lot. I help everybody, man, all my life, you know. And I never thought I can't get help, you know.
Were you getting unemployment now?
I was getting it. Yes, ma'am, I'm getting it.
Were you getting the extra $600 a week?
When it first started, yes, ma'am.
And it got cut off now,
it got
now,
cut
right?
off. Now it's $175 a week.
How's it affecting you?
I mean, by the time I go around the corner, that money's gone in about 2 days or a day and a half.
I'm trying to find shelter for the folks behind us who had their house hit by the hurricane.
And what's it saying?
It said there's no shelter near this zip code.
We don't have water. We're suffering. The law enforcement, the National Guard's here, the law enforcement, they're working together. They're shooting at us. If we're catching this outside, they're shooting at us. I got shot at last night.
Here?
Here. I got shot at.
By which force?
The National Guard's in the sheriff's department. Get to your house. Pow, pow. What the hell was going on? This is not mandatory like that.
Was it dark?
It was dark at night. I'm just trying to get from the store and back home.
What's your name, sir?
Aaron Willis.
And what's your situation here?
The roof is messed up. I stayed during the storm. And I got kind of broke window panes and it started coming in the house and everything. I decided to just stay over here.
And do you have electricity or water?
No, I don't have no electricity and no water.
What did you do before you retired?
Before I retired? I'm an electrician. Yeah. Worked for the IBEW.
Ah, you're a union member.
Yeah, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And are you getting any kind of notice or help from the government? Has anyone told you anything?
No, not yet. I don't have insurance, so... and my phone not working. And if my phone got just cut off, I guess, during the storm, I couldn't call nobody.
What's your name, ma'am? Tell me your story.
Patricia, I'm raising my grandson. My husband's paralyzed, waist down. And we just don't know much people here. So any little help that anybody can give us, thank you, Lord. We appreciate it. And thank you for giving us this.
Have you been visited by any officials for help or told anything?
Nothing. Not a thing. Y'all the only one that gives something. Thank y'all so much. Thank you.
Do you have a cell phone?
Yeah, I have a cell phone, but it don't work. Sprint is out, completely out.
How'd your husband become paralyzed?
He was working, fell off the truck.
Oh.
18-wheeler.
Oh, when did that happen?
I think in 2012, something like that.
And did he get SSI? Is he on disability?
He on disability, and that's our monthly income disability.
And that's not much.
That ain't much.
We have a lot of stuff to give.
Okay.
But we just want to ask, do you have water here today?
Yes, we do.
Running water?
Not running water. We got run, but it's slow, very slow. So what I did, I filled the tub up. All the flush the commode.
Yeah.
You see, now take it back, because right now, Lake Charles said the water is not right. Yeah. Since that plant got blowed up, whatever they did, it went into the water, so it is all messed up.
Man, what's the hardest thing about this storm for y'all?
Oh, the heat.
Heat.
I need a generator. If they can keep out a generator.
Do you have electricity?
No.
Mm-mm.
And it went out in the storm?
Yes,
ma'am.
What have you heard about when it might get restored?
We haven't.
We haven't noticed. This is going to be a while.
Oh, my God.
Okay, another storm. Well, let's get going. We'll give you some stuff here, okay?
Okay, thank you, ma'am.
There are many people we met who don't have house insurance. That shouldn't be an obstacle to having their home rebuilt, rehabilitated, and made habitable again. In other words, we know that the government has plenty of resources because the working class of this country produces all that wealth. We know that corporations like Google, Facebook, Whole Foods, Amazon, Twitter, that they made hundreds of billions of dollars in profit in this pandemic, and yet pay virtually none or no taxes at all, while the working class has to suffer the way that we see.
There's just so many different stories of people struggling here in Louisiana, and it's completely unnecessary.
Those were voices from hurricane-stricken southern Louisiana, recorded by Gloria LaRiva, presidential candidate of the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and members of her party, on the ground in southern Louisiana. The petrochemical industry is the region's principal employer. You can see the video at Federal Relief for Lake Charles on the YouTube. In Berkeley, for Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison. Thank you.
House Majority Whip Congressman James Clyburn and the House Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Crisis held a hearing about election safety on September 9th to discuss concerns about safe voting and availability in Florida, Texas, Wisconsin, and Georgia.
National plan to stop the spread. As a result, more than 190,000 Americans have died, and the coronavirus is continuing to kill hundreds and infect tens of thousands every day. Over the next 8 weeks, Americans will be casting their votes in the midst of this ongoing crisis, all in a free, fair, and safe election under these circumstances is a challenge. But let there be no doubt, if we all do our part, America is up to the challenge. In June, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued simple, clear guidance to keep people healthy while casting their votes. The fundamental principle of this public health guidance is, and I quote, reducing the number of voters who congregate indoors in polling locations at the same time, end of quote. The CDC guidance includes three key elements. First, CDC calls for, and I quote, alternatives to in-person voting. That includes voting by mail and drop boxes to safely collect ballots. Second, CDC calls for, quoting again, increasing the number of polling locations available for early voting and extending the hours of operation. Third, CDC recommends that election administrators, and quoting again, maintain or increase the number of polling places available to the public on election day. These simple steps are achievable everywhere in America, and I am pleased that many state and local officials, both Democrats and Republicans, have made progress in implementing them. Unfortunately, not every jurisdiction is following the CDC's guidance. The consequences of this refusal are predictable. We saw what happened in this year's primary elections in states that reduced the number of polling places and did not have adequate alternatives to in-person voting. In Georgia, voters waited up to 5 hours to cast their ballots. In Texas, voters endured lines up to 7 hours long. In Wisconsin's largest city, Milwaukee, 97% of polling places were closed, leading to long lines for the city's voters. In Florida, 112 polling places across the state were closed, moved, or consolidated. These actions left many voters, especially people of color, unable to exercise their right to vote. We cannot allow the pandemic to be used as a cover to continue or exacerbate the ugly history of voter suppression. In August, the Select Subcommittee launched an investigation to determine whether states where primary voters face significant barriers to casting ballots have made necessary improvements for the general election. Today, we are issuing a staff report with some troubling findings that must be corrected. I ask unanimous consent that this report be entered into the record and without objections, so ordered. In Texas, local election officials warned that voters could be waiting in lines for hours on election day and reported that not having enough poll workers is their primary concern about the upcoming election. Given Texas' refusal to expand absentee voting, it is crucial that Texas take steps now to recruit poll workers rather than resorting to closing polling places and reducing hours. Georgia is making a puzzling choice not to mail out absentee ballot applications to all voters for the general election after successfully doing so for the primary. Georgia's Secretary of State has claimed that mailing out applications to all voters would lead to longer lines at the polls, but the reality is just the opposite. Every voter who casts an absentee ballot is a voter who will not be in line at the polls. We need every state to follow the CDC guidelines so that all voters can cast their vote safely. The federal government also has a crucial role to play. The HEROES Act, which the House passed nearly 4 months ago, includes $3.6 billion to help state and local governments pay for equipment and staff to safely administer the election. Republicans should agree to allocate these funds without further delay. The Delivering for America Act, which the House passed last month, requires that election mail be treated as first class, restores mail service to previous levels, and provides $25 billion as unanimously requested by the bipartisan Postal Service Board of Governors. Unfortunately, rather than play a constructive role in preparing for the election, the Trump administration has been sowing discord, fear, and confusion. President Trump has claimed that mail-in voting will lead to fraud, even though the evidence shows Americans are more likely to get struck by lightning than to commit voter fraud by mail. There is good reason the president has been unable to provide evidence to support his claim. There is none.
Congressman James Clyburn about election safety on September 9th.
People are basically vehicles to just create money, which must create more money to keep the whole thing from falling apart, which is what's happening. There is no profit under the current paradigm in saving lives, putting balance on this planet, having justice and peace or anything else. You have to create problems to create profit.
You're listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
What's the bubble? Find out more from Johanna Fernandez, host of It's a New Day, WBAI, along with Dr. Kwaku Ramal-Smith, psychologist for the NBA.
I'm Johanna Fernandez, and I'm speaking to Dr. Kwaku Ramal-Smith, psychologist of the NBA and the former team psychologist for the Milwaukee Bucks. And we're talking about race and mental health in the world of sports, but also the ways in which the crisis in Milwaukee is reflected and was reflected in the actions of the Milwaukee Bucks. And you're listening. I think we need to repeat this for our listening audience and for the world to hear that the Milwaukee Bucks reflect, in fact, in their team, the deep, profound oppression that Black people experience in that region and that area, which has the highest number of incarcerated people, Black people, in the country. And that one of the players of the Bucks was himself brutalized by police. Now, we're talking about the bubble, but I don't know that folks that know exactly what the bubble is. I just found out about it myself researching for this interview. Can you tell us about the bubble? What is it? But also, how might it have influenced the atmosphere in the game, the players, and the strike? And I ask this because I think, and many people have suggested, that the uprisings we saw in the aftermath of George Floyd's assassination, I don't think we can call it anything other than that, happened in part because we were all sitting in our homes looking at the horrors of a country that had allowed people to die of COVID-19. So tell us, what is the bubble?
When you think of a bubble, what do you think of? Something that encapsulates, something that kind of protects you from everything. And so when we look at like a snow globe, you look inside of a city, you know, and you kind of look at it from an ocular, you know, a visual standpoint. And a snow globe is stunning in what it is. It's beautiful. But how many of us would want to live in a snow globe? Because of COVID-19, because of the stoppage of the NBA play, and because of the economic burden that was being taken by the NBA, they were looking ferociously for an option to be able to keep the players safe. They were looking for an option to make sure that the season didn't end abruptly, that there could be a continuation. And so they had to figure out exactly how to do it. So in concept, theoretically, is actually brilliant, because what they did is they got all of the players and essential staff to be able to say, let's quarantine, let's make sure we're all free of COVID-19, and let's put us in a place where only we can be. So it's like a little safe place. They had their own little special Wakanda, if you will. And so they did it on the resort of Orlando, of Walt Disney. So, you know, you look at it and you say, oh, this is a beautiful spot. So it's not like being institutionalized or incarcerated in a prison, or it's not even like being off at war where you're away from everything, but you have these disastrous positions. But what we have to recognize is this. We, as a people, are social beings. And when you go into a bubble, you know what you did to the players? You took them away from their mothers. You took them away from their fathers. You took them away from their children. You took them away from their spouses or their girlfriends, significant others. You took them away from their friends. You took them away from some of the resources that they had to deal to cope with. What most people don't understand is, because they see the outside of a pro athlete's life, they think it's all glamour and glitz. But that could be far from the truth. As I stated before, there's a high level of depression, and that's been documented in multiple outlets, news and sports outlets, about players coming out about their high levels of depression. So think about how many others suffer with that in silence. And when we say, well, maybe they say they don't, but we see the manifestation of behaviors of people who heavily self-medicate, of people who have high domestic violence, of people who have other contrary behaviors with hypersexual behavior, things of that nature, where you know something is going on. Well, now you take away those resources from the people and you put them inside of that bubble, inside of that beautiful area, but away from the people. You create an amount of stress. We can do it for one day. We can do it for a week. We're used to that. We're isolated. When I was with the team, we would go to Las Vegas for about 2 weeks. And even though you had the whole city, it wasn't with COVID, you were pretty much stuck in the city. And you were there for 2 weeks, and that was difficult. And we had the ability to still have a lot of those luxuries and amenities and whatnot like that. But now you take that and you put this over time, and they've been in that bubble at the time of the boycott. It was over 50 days at that time. And so now what you start to have is a high level of frustration. And to your exact point, COVID-19, it did that to our nation, and we saw it because people were willing to go out and vote. People were willing to go out in the midst of a pandemic to be able to talk about the outrage that they had specifically with George Floyd. Now, when you know people would risk going into a pandemic to be able to voice their frustration, you knew it wasn't just all about George Floyd. It was also, it was that cabin fever that goes on. But it was the perfect storm that was brewing because they said, if there's a time for me to go out, if there's a time for me to literally risk my life, this would be a time. And so now let's go back inside that bubble, that isolated place where only NBA and NBA officials and friends are at this specific time. The players was like, we don't know if we want to be here in the first place. You look at people all the way from LeBron James to people who had escaped the bubble and left the bubble, you know, at some periods of time because they had to get out of there. It was something that was going on before anything happened to Brother Jacob Floyd. But when the Jacob Floyd incident hit, there became an overwhelming sense of guilt for the players saying, hey, are we doing what we're supposed to be doing for our communities? Are we doing enough? Are we lending our voice? And because they had become more collectively and socially conscious, even wondering if they should go to the bubble, thinking that maybe we were being used to be a panacea or to be at least a distraction for the people to get their minds off of that so they wouldn't be marching in the streets but staying at home watching these games. They've always felt that sense of burden and like, are we being an addition to the problem? Are we helping the problem? Or are we really contributing something greatly? And so when all of those things happened, it came to a point where they was like, I don't want to be in this bubble, no way. And if there's any time to leave, this would be the time to leave. We have a legitimate excuse. But then the question became, if we do leave this bubble, what do we do next? And I think because they weren't well equipped to say exactly what we want to do, and there was a sense of division then at that point, like exactly how do we activate our activism, that's why they remained in the bubble. But some of the people in the bubble are very upset about that. And as you start to see teams lose from the playoffs because the playoffs are going, you never see players as relieved to leave the playoffs as you are seeing this year. Because although they are sad that their destination will not end in the championship, there's a solid relief in knowing that they will get to go home. And whether they do things from an activist standpoint or work with their family, just to be able to leave that bubble where they are isolated from all of the things that they're used to having, is there. And I guess the best way to say it, to sum it up, is this. You think about when you go on a wonderful vacation. It doesn't matter how wonderful it is. At a period of time, you say, you know what? I want my own bed. I want to go back home. You know, and so you think about being away. Now, these guys are there for over 60 days now, and with this heavy stress on there, it's a lot. So the bubble, like I said, theoretically is a good place to keep people physically safe from COVID, but it also has alternate counterproductive effects on them emotionally and mentally.
Johanna Fernandez, host of It's a New Day, WBAI, along with Dr. Kwaku Ramal-Smith, first Black psychologist for the NBA. Dr. Michio Kaku, theoretical physicist, best-selling author, renowned futurist, gives a report on the COVID pandemic in America.
Speculation is rising to a fever pitch concerning vaccinations. The medical establishment has said that perhaps by late this year or early next year, mass vaccinations will take place. In fact, of the 30 to 50 different vaccinations that are being tested right now, two are front runners, and people expect that these two varieties of vaccinations will, in fact, be administered by the tens of millions. And then, of course, now the question is, who gets it first? Well, right now there is no national policy, but that doesn't stop people from speculating as to what the national priority should be. But after that, it's pretty much a free-for-all, because right now there is no designated national policy concerning who gets the vaccination first. And then, of course, we have to worry, even if you are vaccinated, how long will the effect last? We don't know. There are some reports, sporadic reports, but verified reports, showing that certain individuals have been infected not once, but twice. Once in Hong Kong, twice in Europe, and once in the United States. So this is not just a fluke, we think, but it still has to be investigated. Will you have a booster shot after getting vaccinated? We simply don't know. Not to mention the fact that we are now in phase three. And in phase three, already 30,000 individuals are now being tested concerning the coronavirus. And of course, the Russians and the Chinese have now jumped the gun. Both China and Russia have indicated that they have gotten their vaccination in order. In fact, in Russia, over 70 individuals have already been tested with their version of the vaccine. And of course, the Russians have been criticized because of lack of testing, but the Russians have said that eventually up to 40,000 people in Russia will be tested to make sure that the vaccine is safe. Well, who knows for sure what's really going to happen, but it's going to be very interesting to watch in the middle of an election year. Also, new recommendations may be coming concerning how to avoid the coronavirus. You remember way back in January, governments were saying, humbug. You don't have to even wear a mask. In fact, don't wear a mask because that'll take away from first responders and medical workers. Don't wear a mask. That was the original recommendation. Now, of course, the authorities are saying that you should wear a mask, that in fact, you should also wash your hands and don't touch your face. But there's also a probability that a new set of recommendations will come into play because of new evidence that keeps piling in. For example, the CDC still says that you should stay 6 feet away from other individuals. However, now people are saying that maybe 6 feet is the minimum distance, that if anything, you should make even larger separations between people. And second of all, you should wear glasses or a face shield of some sort because the coronavirus can enter not just your nose, your mouth, but also your eyes as well. Also, avoid being indoors. It turns out that you are 20 times more likely to get the virus if you are indoors versus being outdoors. And also avoid people who sing, who yell, speak a lot for long periods of time. In fact, just by talking to an individual, you can spread 1,000 particles with the virus per minute. And if you are shouting to people, you can spread up to 10,000 particles per minute. So in other words, keep your distance, avoid people who sing, speak, yell, or chant, wear a face shield, try to avoid being indoors. Now, on top of that, some scientists believe that yet another set of recommendations will be made, and that is stop smoking, don't do vaping, and lose weight. It turns out that smokers are twice as likely to feel the burden of the virus, twice as likely to catch it and suffer severe consequences than the average person. And if you want a vapor, realize that you're five times more likely to come down with the virus and have serious side effects. And also, what is one of the number one characteristics of people that have a very severe reaction to the coronavirus? And that is obesity. And just remember that the United States has one of the highest rates of obesity in the entire world. So perhaps it's not an accident that the United States also has one of the highest rates of the coronavirus in the world. And so some people are saying that maybe we should change recommendations. Stop smoking, stop vaping, and lose weight, and live longer as a consequence. And by the way, scientists are beginning to understand why is it that people who are obese tend to react so severely to the coronavirus. It's one of the leading indicators. Well, it turns out there are several theories. One is that people who are obese have a hard time adjusting to the ventilator. Because of the extra body fat, they're at a disadvantage compared to other people who are healthy and have a strong immune system. And also hormonal imbalance takes place if you are obese. But there's yet another reason. The virus enters your body through a receptor on your cells called the ACE2 receptor. It's like a lock and a key. The virus is the key, and the lock is the ACE2 receptor. It turns out that people who are obese have more receptors than normal. That could also be a contributing factor to the reason why obesity is one of the most frequent markers for the coronavirus that is constantly being seen in hospitals. If you are obese, it greatly puts the odds against you when it comes to the coronavirus.
That was theoretical physicist and best-selling author Dr. Michio Kaku.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
Do you have the tools to cope with the COVID-19 pandemic, violence, and racism? WPFW host Verna Avery Brown and Sister Dr. Jenna, acclaimed spiritual mentor, shares her thoughts and wisdom, thanks to Lona Alliance for co-producing this segment.
How do you understand or interpret spiritually what we're going through in America and globally?
Sure. It's definitely the time of entropy, which means that we're in the cycle where there's the chaos because it's fighting and it's struggling for order. And when we look at the narrative that is being distributed through the media and through the voices of leadership, if you're not discerning about who you are and why you're here, you can get distracted and get caught up in the vibration that they're trying to give to you to weaken your abilities. And so my recommendation always to folks, forget it. It's a game, and it's a game for a particular group of people who feel that the only way they can stay in authority is to disempower you. But you have to choose if you want to be disempowered or if you'd like to stand in your power. So I feel that this particular period that we're in, it's normal. It's all of us that played a role in this. Every time you get frustrated, angry, make a critical remark, make a judgment on someone, we were adding to the energy. And it reaches a particular point of critical mass, but it can't be hidden anymore. And so what we're seeing at a global level, is that our own stuff, you know, that stuff inside that needs clearing out, that stuff has reached its climax, and it wants to be rid. It needs to get out. It needs to be burnt. It needs to be burnt. And so the situations that we're finding ourselves in are actually a catalyst in trying to direct us back inwards to do the real work that we needed to do. But as I was sharing earlier, everyone, we just have to become discerning and recognize that there are people out there who want to disempower our minds. Our minds, it's the most powerful tool that we have. And so if we buy into the rhetoric and just keep talking about it and talking about it, we become like that energy. So what we're witnessing now is that we have a very powerful choice. We have the ability to make a very, very powerful decision now. Do I take the high road or do I stay where they are? I don't want to stay where they are. I know the game that they're playing. My question is, how do I inspire and empower my brothers and sisters who don't understand that people are playing them? And that's through spiritual empowerment.
So when you say people are playing them, who are these people?
People that have the ability to transmit messages at a large level. That if I have a platform that I can influence you and there's something I'm getting from you that I want, right, for maybe my own selfish needs, then I will speak to you in a way that I know only you will receive. Not that it makes your life any better, but because I'm looking for power. I was looking at the form of leadership of today, and I found that there are so many people, celebrities, billionaires, millionaires, religious. religious leaders. They have so much potential and power to create change for the positive. Why doesn't it happen? Why don't they use their platform to turn this around? And that's because in some very unique way, they can sometimes be such self-serving, such a self-serving nature that folks are so attached to their I, their me, and their mine in consciousness that they're not really thinking about the we. They talk about the we, but talk is different than the walk, okay? Mm-hmm. If they were walking the we, I don't think we'd be in where we are now. I don't think we'd be in this position. I think
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, please go.
Well, so we're not really talking about some grand conspiracy, but basically individuals who are self-centered and selfish and doing what serves their own self-interest.
Yeah, and haven't you been there? I've been there. I know what it feels like, and I know the result of what that was like. And as I grow and continue to grow, I realize that doesn't serve the greater whole. It doesn't. A sacrifice is made when I'm selfish, and a sacrifice is made when I'm selfless. But at least when I'm selfless, others are benefited. So why not take that route?
Sister Dr. Jenna, acclaimed spiritual mentor.
I don't want to write this down. I don't want to tell you how I feel right now. I don't wanna take no time to write this down. I wanna tell you how I feel right now. Hey, tomorrow may never come for you or me. Life is not promised. Tomorrow may never show up for you and me. This life is not promised. I ain't no perfect man. I'm trying to do the best that I can with what it is I have. I ain't no perfect man. I'm trying to do the best that I can with what it is I have. Put my heart and soul into the song.
Yes, yes.
I hope you feel me from where I am to wherever you are. I mean that sincerely. Tomorrow may never come. For you and me, life is not promised. Tomorrow may never appear. You better hold this very moment very close to you.
Right now.
Very close to you.
Right now.
So close to you.
Right now.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
As he came to the end of his introduction, he said, I would like to present to you a fellow untouchable from the United States of America. And for the moment, I was peeved, I was shocked that I would be introduced as an untouchable. Pretty soon, my mind ran back across to America. And I started thinking about the fact that there were so many places that I couldn't go because of the color of my skin. I started thinking about the fact that my 20 million brothers and sisters in the Negro community of America still at the bottom of the economic ladder, deprived of adequate housing conditions, unable to live in numerous neighborhoods because of the color of their skin. I started thinking about the fact that my little children were still judged on the basis of the color of their skin rather than the content of their character. And I had to say to myself, I am an untouchable, and every Negro in the United States is an untouchable.
That is Dr. Martin Luther King speaking in 1965 about his 1959 visit to India.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Isabel Wilkerson appeared on Democracy Now! To discuss her new groundbreaking book, Caste, The Origins of Our Discontent, An Examination of the Racial Caste System in America, similar to the caste system in India, and how Dr. Martin Luther King was referred to as an untouchable during his travels to India.
Isabel Wilkerson, you write magnificently about this journey and how you came to look at this country like others look at India, talking about the centrality of caste. Tell us more about Dr. King's visit to India.
Well, he arrived in 1959, obviously inspired by the country and by the leadership of Mohandas K. Gandhi, who had inspired his nonviolent approach to freeing African Americans from the grip of what he ultimately would identify as a caste system in his own country, in the United States. And so he arrived to visit the school, and as we so eloquently heard his reciting, recalling that experience, it at first, when he was identified or he was introduced to the children, to the students there, as an untouchable, the word landed a little oddly for him because he hadn't thought of himself in that way. And as he considered and scrolled back into his memories of and experiences and recognition of all of the things that had been restricted for both him and the 20 million other African Americans that he was fighting for, he himself, Dr. King, recognized that America had beneath its infrastructure a caste system that was not as different from India as we might like to believe.
And Isabel Wilkerson, first of all, I want to congratulate you on such a marvelously written book, just as your first, your earlier book was so marvelously written. And I wanted to ask you about a particular section of it where you write, caste is the bone, race is the skin. Caste is fixed and rigid. Race is fluid and superficial, subject to periodic redefinition to meet the needs of the dominant caste in what is now the United States. If you could expound for those of our readers who, of our viewers who haven't read your book yet, this relationship that you try to delve into between caste and race.
Well, first I want to say that I came to the concept of race through the first book that I wrote, The Warm Feather Sons, in which I was writing about the flight of 6 million African Americans who were escaping the Jim Crow South. And in writing about what they had endured, writing about what the Jim Crow South was actually like, a lot of Americans have not really gotten that true exposure to what it was like to live in that world where everything that you could do or could not do was based upon what you looked like, that it was actually against the law for a black person and a white person to play checkers together. So I was recreating that world, and recreating that world, I did not use the word racism because it did not seem sufficient to capture the totality of the and the comprehensive nature of the control, restrictions, and boundaries. So I came to, so that calls upon us to think about, well, what does caste mean? What is caste? So caste system essentially is an arbitrary grading, an artificial graded ranking of human value in a society. And it's one in which there's a fixed infrastructure that in our country predates anyone who's alive today. It goes all the way back to colonial times when the country was being formed. And a caste system essentially determines one's standing, the respect accorded a person, the benefit of the doubt, access to resources, or the deprivation of access to those resources, even such things as assumptions of competence and beauty. So this is the hierarchy that we have all inherited, that no one alive created, but we have inherited it, and we live under the shadow of that system.
You also write about what you call the middle caste of Asians, Latinos, indigenous people, and new immigrants of African descent, who you say navigate within what began as a bipolar hierarchy. I'm wondering if you could explain that, and also why you chose to include indigenous people in the middle caste, when some would argue that certainly in the United States and certainly in Latin America, there has been a long existing caste system toward the native peoples, whether it's in Peru, Bolivia, Ecuador, Mexico, and of course, in the United States. So why you felt that the indigenous people should be included among this middle caste?
First of all, the caste system, as I'm describing it, we have to go back to where it began. It began with the creation of the country, which in which the people who were the colonists, who were British, placed themselves, obviously, at the top of the hierarchy, and then brought people in from Africa to be the enslaved people, who would automatically, by definition, be at the very bottom of the caste system, having no rights whatsoever, not even rights over their own bodies. And so there also were, of course, the indigenous people who were the First Nations of this land, who then were in some ways exiled from the caste system that was being created as in a bipolar caste system. So in many respects, and I also say that they are in some ways outside, forced to be outside of the caste system in the ways that the colonists devised it by forcing them off of their land. The bipolar caste system is meant that there were basically two main groups that were the foundation as the country created. And then anyone entering this bipolar caste system then had to figure out where they fit in, had to somehow navigate what had been created as a two-tiered system. And the infrastructure that had been created had to also decide, you know, assigned people to roles on the basis primarily of what they look like and what their lineage might have been, what part of the world they come from. So when people were arriving, say, from Europe, they were not, from outside of Northern Europe, they were not necessarily thinking of themselves as white. The white was not a label that had been applied or needed to be applied, I should say, to someone who was living in 16th century of what would now be Ireland or Hungary or Poland. In other words, people who were arriving to the United States in the early decades and even century of history in the United States were not arriving as white people in their minds. They were arriving as Irish or Polish or Hungarian. Upon arrival, though, they were assigned to the category, essentially a new category. The idea of race is a fairly new one, going back only about 500 years, race as we currently know it. So they had to then navigate and readjust their identity in order to meet the expectations of this caste system that they were entering. And so did other people who were coming from other parts of the world. The United States in the late 19th century and early 20th century went to a great deal of trouble to curate its population, particularly those who were not coming from Northern Europe. And so anyone coming from outside of Northern Europe then had to be fit into this caste system. And that meant that there was a tremendous amount of disillusion and a tremendous amount of restlessness about trying to figure out who would fit. So there were a lot of legal challenges of people coming from Asia, people coming from other parts of the world to petition for the recognition of citizenship, petition ultimately for the recognition of being able to fit into what was the category of the dominant caste, which would have been white or Caucasian at that time. And so this is a work in progress, has always been a work in progress. And so anyone coming in from outside of what these poles that were arbitrary, random designations of human beings, ended up having to find a way to navigate. And it created this stressors and tensions between groups as they tried to figure out how to survive in an often forbidding bipolar structure.
That was Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Isabel Wilkerson, author of Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents. Special thanks to Democracy Now! This concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates that contributed to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by yours truly, Akua Holds, and edited by Paulina Vasiliev. Our executive producers are Akua Holds, Paulina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. Verna Avery Brown is our executive consultant. I am Akua Holds. Thanks for listening. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Time. people do not choose rebellion. It is forced upon them. Revolution is always an act of self-defense. Reverend Dr. C. T. Vivian.
My ambition, shine your light on the world. Shine your light.